Eyes, hazel. Hair, brown. Complexion, light. Distinctive features. Appears to squint, actually has 20/15 vision. Slight stutter on the letter L. Ethnicity, American of Austrian, German, Dutch heritage. Nationality, U.S. Language fluency ratings. American English, 5. German, 4. French, Spanish, 3. Note, as part of preparation for Kalonji Deed, underwent immersive training in medieval Hebrew, fluency rating 1.5, Byzantine Greek, 2, and medieval Dutch, 2. Religion, non-observant Lutheran. Citizenship, American. Biography. Raised in middle-class home in Connecticut, father owned auto shop, mother a nurse, formerly for Médecins Sans Frontières, dyslexic. Majored in phys ed at UConn, emphasis on cross-country and wilderness survival skills. Former USA Olympic track and field team, took bronze in marathon. Worked at Outward Bound, involved in various extreme sports activities, including cliff jumping, rock climbing, parkour. Recruitment. Personal contact by Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons, whom he met while leading a rock climbing expedition, Lyons, 14 at the time. They became friends and continued to engage in wilderness-oriented athletic activities together. Skill set. Extremely fit, hardy, capable of functioning under punishing physical circumstances, natural or man-made. Physically nondescript enough to blend into crowd in most Caucasian populations. Decent MacGyver-like capabilities. Loyalty unshakable. Limitations. Dyslexic. Not comfortable in conversationally dependent situations. More comfortable in rural than urban-suburban surroundings. Post by Mortimer Shore on General Odin Channel. Day 622.
Hey all. In the wake of yesterday's incident in the cafeteria line, Macy Stoll has asked me to post a few safety tips that you all should keep in mind until such time as we can print up posters, establish training programs, etc. Just as background, the requirement for fighter class diachronic operatives, doers, to achieve and maintain proficiency in various historical martial arts styles entails wearing, transporting, storing, and using a wide range of historical weapons and weapon simulators on premises. No single blanket policy can cover all such cases, but here are some general rules. Scabbards are trip hazards. Glance down before stepping behind a sword fighter. Assume all blades are razor sharp. If you see something falling out of a scabbard, don't try to catch it.
Dodo White Paper. UDET, or Diachronic Mission Duration, by Rebecca East Oda. Submitted to Odin Archive, Day 622.
The recent influx of funding and new personnel has led Dodo staff to look more deeply into certain aspects of how diachronic operations are conducted that hitherto we had just taken for granted. In particular, the need to schedule complex missions, such as the upcoming Kalonji-related DEET, has forced us to think in greater detail about the duration of missions and how many can be scheduled in a given span of time. Most of Dodo's experience has centered on the colonial Boston and Elizabethan London deeds conducted last year by Dr. Stokes and Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, respectively. Both of these were of relatively brief duration. Dr. Stokes was able to accomplish her tasks in the course of a single day. With the exception of the first repetition, Lieutenant Colonel Lyons's deed was a sleepover in which he had to spend one night at the DTAP. In all of these cases, the responsible witches, KCWs Carpety, Fitch, and Grania, acted in a way that preserved unity of doer experienced time. Here and after, UDET. The idea of UDET is simple and can be quickly explained. If Dr. Stokes experienced 8 hours of elapsed time during her mission in colonial Boston, then the same span of time separated her being sent by Carpathy from the ODAC to the DTAP and her reappearance in the ODAC upon being returned home by K.C.W. Fitch. Likewise, when Lieutenant Colonel Lyons spent approximately 24 hours in the 1601 London DTAP, the same amount of elapsed time occurred between his being sent there and his being homed by K.C.W. Grania. UDET means that from the point of view of the doer as well as observers in the facility, it is as if the doer walked through a door into another room, spent 8 or 24 hours there, and then walked back through the same door. This does not pose a serious inconvenience for short missions. By contrast, however, the nature of the Kalonji deed is such that it cannot be accomplished in less than approximately 2 months. For those unfamiliar with the premise of this deed, a short explanation follows. We are attempting to recruit Winifred Dutton, a potential KCW in Antwerp, circa 1560. The only way we have found to motivate her is by supplying her with samples of an herb called Kalonji, which is rare and nearly unobtainable in her time and place. We have found a source for Kalonji seeds in Constantinople circa 1200, which is a DTAP of interest to us anyway. The current plan of record is to send one doer to 1200 Constantinople to obtain the seeds. She will then hand them off to a wilderness survival expert, Strider class, who will carry them overland to Belgium and sow them in a known location where we think that they will thrive. It should then be possible to visit that location circa 1560 and harvest the herb in the wild. The plan's primary drawback is that the overland journey from Constantinople to Belgium is projected to take 2 months, and it will have to be repeated on at least 3 strands in order for it to take. Our strider will therefore have to experience a total of at least 6 months of our elapsed time in that DTAP. If the mission is performed in a way that preserves UDET, then the strider will indeed be absent for a total of 6 months. If, on the other hand, we can arrange for the strider to be homed from 1200 Belgium only a few minutes after he is sent to 1200 Constantinople, then the entire series of missions could be conducted in less than a day, as time is perceived by those of us here in modern-day Boston. The strider would still be 6 months older at the end of it, and would have 6 months' worth of memories from his journeys, but the clock, as far as Dodo is concerned, would only have advanced a few hours. The latter procedure is obviously a more efficient use of time, as far as Dodo is concerned. Moreover, to the extent Dodo is engaged in a competition versus the diachronic operations agencies of foreign powers, we must assume that our adversaries are making use of such optimization wherever possible and are getting their jobs done that much more quickly. This is a topic that has been on several people's minds for some months now, and that has been brought to the front burner, as it were, by the Kalonji deed planning process. Initial attempts to raise the question with KCW Elizabeth Carpathy proved unavailing, as the very idea of it made very little sense to her, and could seemingly gain no purchase on her mind. She could not make heads or tails of what it was that we were asking her to do, much less express an opinion on it, and repeatedly accused us of being demented or insane. As the overall emotional tone was becoming counterproductive, I was asked to work with her on the topic, since I have known her for longer than most Dodo employees, and she trusts me on the basis of the belief that I am descended from witches and that I have some latent magical ability. The results of my inquiry are detailed below. A top-level summary is that deed time compression does not appear to be a practical option, largely because witches have great difficulty even understanding the idea and consider it to be reckless, far-fetched, and childish. The best analogy I can think of is how a modern physicist would react if you approached him and proposed to travel at greater than the speed of light. Mixed with this is a little bit of how Chopin would react if you proposed to play a piano by striking it with a sledgehammer. Detailed analysis. Witches' objections to deed time compression, witches' objections to DD time compression, to the extent they can even fathom the idea, can apparently be broken down into two general categories. One, the asymmetry between sending and homing a time traveler, and two, the risk of something akin to present-day diachronic shear. One, sending, homing, asymmetry. Non-witches are apt to think of sending, moving a doer from an Odek back in time to a D-tap, and homing, the reverse process, as the same thing. But it turns out that from the witch's point of view, they are entirely different spells. The contrasts are explained in the following. Sending. Back in time. Once sent to the past, the doer can take actions that might affect the present-day reality of the sending witch, the doer, him, herself, etc. Homing. Forward in time. Once homed back to the present day, the doer's actions cannot affect the past reality of the homing witch, etc. Sending. The D-tap is terra incognita to both the sending witch and the doer. Must be extensively researched beforehand from historical documents, maps, and scrying. Homing. The destination is perfectly familiar to the doer, but unknown and nearly unimaginable to the homing witch, for whom it is in the distant future. Sending. The doer is moving from their natural time and place to one where they are an unnatural intrusion. Homing. The doer is moving from a place where they fundamentally do not belong back to their natural time and place. For these reasons, witches think of sending and homing as asymmetrical and fundamentally different spells. Sending is much more difficult, first of all because it entails more advanced prep work if it is not to produce a random result, and secondly because it means working against the natural flow of time. An analogy might be made to a rubber band connecting the doer to their natural time and place. When the doer is sent to a past D-tap, the rubber band is stretched, which requires more effort and more focus on the witch's part if the doer is not to end up in the wrong place. When the same doer is homed, it is as if their connection to the D-tap is simply severed by the homing witch. The rubber band yanks the doer unerringly back to the Odek from which they were sent. Indeed, if this were not the case, diachronic operations would not be possible at all. In the case of Dr. Stokes's colonial Boston deed, how could K.C.W. Fitch possibly have returned Dr. Stokes to the Odek in modern-day Boston, a time, place, and environment beyond her imagining, if not for this snap-back effect? The rubber band feature of homing is therefore fundamental to Dodo's ability to do anything at all. But there is a catch. If the doer has experienced 8 hours or 17 days in the D-tap, the rubber band yanks them back to the Odak 8 hours or 17 days after they departed. Compressing mission time by returning the doer to an earlier moment is therefore not simply a matter of using the homing spell in a different way, turning the knobs to different settings, as it were. It would require a different spell altogether, and the witch performing it would have to have some prior familiarity with the future DTaP in order to aim the doer in the correct direction. 2. Sheer risk. Witches appear to have a nose for situations apt to produce diachronic sheer. Mission duration compression seems to be one of those. If a homebound doer can be homed back to the wrong time, that is, earlier than the natural snapback time, then they could just as well be sent home before they departed, which would lead to a situation in which two copies of the same doer were existing in the same time and place. Other absurd or paradoxical situations could be imagined. Let us say that a 20-year-old doer were sent back to a DTaP where they lived for 60 years, then homed to a point in time only a fraction of a second after their departure. From the point of view of an observer in the ODEC, it would be as if the 20-year-old were instantaneously replaced by an 80-year-old. Such possibilities are deeply distressing to witches, who seem to see in them a kind of moral and aesthetic abomination. To sum up, it appears that the idea of compressing mission duration is a non-starter. From the witch's point of view, it requires getting a compliant witch in the distant past to undertake an unfamiliar spell of extreme difficulty, all to achieve an end result that is viewed as both insanely risky and viscerally repugnant. We are, therefore, stuck with Udet for the foreseeable future, and it seems safe to say that our adversaries are in the same boat. Dodo personnel planning the Kalanji Sea Deed, or other time-consuming missions, will have to take that reality into account. Fortunately, we have the luxury of time at the moment, since we are awaiting the completion of the Chronotron.
Dodo Memorandum. Policy on Official Jargon and Acronym Coinage by Macy Stoll, MBA. Posted 02-11-45, day 623.
Now that I've had time to settle into my new role as head of CCOD, that is, Dodo's Conventional / Contemporary Operations Department. For those of you who've been tucked away in exotic DTaps during the recent organizational upgrades, I'm beginning to see opportunities for optimizing and perfecting the way Dodo operates on a day-to-day basis. In coming weeks, we're going to be challenging ourselves to implement new procedures and policies that will help ensure that the taxpayers get the most for their hard-earned dollars, even though hopefully none of them will ever know of Dodo's existence. Communications becomes all important in a large organization. Informal practices that worked well when it was just a few friends sitting around a table at the Apostolic Cafe may no longer be well adapted to a large agency that spans not only the globe, but most of recorded history as well. In that spirit, I would like to take up the subject of jargon and acronyms. Now, before any of you old dodo hands beats me to it, I'll stipulate that jargon and acronyms are a staple of many large modern organizations, especially in the military and intelligence sectors, where documents sometimes look like a bowl of alphabet soup. I know that perfectly well from my 20 years of experience in such environments. Even so, I was taken aback when I first came to the Department of Diachronic Operations and began to experience a whole new world of exotic terminology and funny strings of letters. Diachronic shear, strands, odex, kipus, doers, and more. Now, some of these, I think, are clear and good terms to use, such as doer, which is self-explanatory, and deed, which I now understand is just an alternate spelling of deed. But in some cases, I do sort of get the idea that a very clever person, perhaps someone from an advanced academic background where wordplay is a kind of sport, is trying to have a teeny little joke at my expense. And maybe also trying to poke fun, in a sly way, at the military world that has brought us so many brave defenders of our freedoms, such as Lieutenant Colonel Lyons and the late General Schneider. For example, lately we have begun to see DORC for Diachronic Operative Resource Center and DOOSH for Diachronic Operative Occupational Safety and Health. Perhaps those of you who have been putting so much of your creative energies into dreaming up these hilarious acronyms might consider putting yourselves into the shoes of Dr. Blevins when he has to give a tour of the facility to a senator or a general or a foreign visitor from one of our allies and finds himself having to explain why such terms are stenciled on doors and bandied about on official letterhead. It certainly doesn't send the message that all the brain power we've gathered together under this roof is being applied in the most productive manner, does it? To impose a little order on all of this creative chaos and to ensure that none of the taxpayers' money is wasted as a result of inefficient communications, I'm putting into place a new Policy on Official Jargon and Acronym Coinage. You'll find full details and procedures in the attached PowerPoint deck, which I encourage you all to peruse at your leisure. Existing acronyms, where widely adopted, can, of course, be grandfathered in, but those of you seeking to add new terms to DODO's specialized lexicon will need to abide by the procedures spelled out in the deck.
Exchange of posts between Dr. Melisande Stokes and Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons on Private Odin Channel, 15:32:37. Afternoon and evening, day 623. Post from Dr. Stokes.
Re Pujak, policy on official jargon, etc. Tristan, do you want to break the news to her, or should I?
Response from Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
Stokes, I know. Everyone's talking about it. Shut up. The first one who calls it Pujak to her face is going to come off either as a malcontent or a snitch. If it's the former, you're going to end up on a PEP.
From Dr. Stokes.
Pep?
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
Try to keep up, Stokes. PEP equals Performance Enhancement Plan. It's what you get assigned to when you are in trouble.
From Dr. Stokes.
First I've heard of it. Has Pep gone through Pujak?
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
What you're not getting is that this is all public. It doesn't matter how secure the Shiny Hat operating system is, Stokes. When the subpoena comes through from the Inspector General, all of what you're writing ends up in public.
From Dr. Stokes.
Just making an observation.
Post by Macy Stoll, Head of CCOD on General Odin Channel. Day 623.
All, there seems to be some confusion brewing in the wake of my memorandum concerning the policy on official jargon and acronym coinage. While I am aware that the letters spell out Pujak, a nonsense word, don't waste your time Googling it, this is not an approved substitute for the full name of the aforementioned policy. Remember, the entire point of the policy is to establish an approved procedure for coining new terminology. And so, to refer to the policy as Pujak is in and of itself a violation of the policy. You can easily spell out the full name of the policy or copy-paste if you are in that much of a hurry. I realize that it's something of a mouthful to use in conversation. Around the office, we have taken to calling it the Jargon and Acronym Policy, and I encourage the rest of you to follow suit.
Follow-up from Stoll 2 hours later.
In the wake of a very respectful and sensitive exchange of feelings with Dr. Oda, I would like to amend the above to Acronym and Jargon Policy. Please refer to DODO's Diversity Policy for more on these matters, which we take extremely seriously.
Follow-up from Stoll 1 hour later.
I have been made aware that our diversity policy is still being drafted. I assumed we had one in place already, but the unusual operational environment of Dodo apparently makes it more complicated. In the meantime, let's all just use common sense, please.
After action report. Debriefer, Dr. Melisande Stokes. Doer, Hira Yassin Lajani. Theater, Constantinople. Operation, Antwerp Witch Recruitment. Deed, obtain/secure viable Kalanji seeds for later pickup. DTAP, Blaherne Palace, Constantinople, August 1202. Strand, fourth and last repetition of this deed. Note, will avoid undue repetition of physical details, etc., from previous three strands. Erzabet sent Hira via Odeck number 2 at 11:15 of day 626 without incident. Hira materialized in the unlit brick bathhouse of the women's apartments of Blaherne Palace. We had already confirmed a witch in Blaherne on previous strands. Basina, illegitimate granddaughter of Empress Irene, nay Bertha. Hira arrived in the dark hours of the morning, but moonlight shone in to give illumination to the room. She has drawn detailed diagram of bathhouse, scanned and converted to 3D renderings. Refer to Dork Cartographic and Architectural Database. General setting, large striated brick hall with marble baths heated from below. Running water available via lead pipes. From prep research combined with past strand experience, she knew that for efficiency in plumbing, the laundry was beside the bathhouses, and a connecting room between the two held cabinets with clean shmatas / drab shifts to be worn by women working in either chamber. After waiting in the shadows to ensure that the coast was clear, she moved quietly to this cabinet and donned one. It would pass as a servant's nightdress. Hira found a small amphora, filled it with water, and carried it from the bathhouse to the stairs for the Empress's apartments. Nearing the foot of the stairs, she encountered two armed Varangian guards. For more on what we know of the arms and armor of this class of fighter, refer to Mortimer Shore's MARS, Martial Arts Research Summary, number 12. She approached them carrying the amphora. They challenged her in accented Greek. She identified herself as a new servant of Basina's, sent to fetch her mistress scented water for a headache. The taller guard was about to let her go, but the shorter one expressed skepticism and proposed accompanying her back upstairs. Speaking in what might have been a Norman dialect, the taller Varangian rebuked the shorter one. Hira cannot understand circa 1200 Norman. Beyond some ability to pick out French and Anglo-Saxon loanwords. Having been on this deed several times now, she is fairly certain that the topic of conversation was a woman named Candida. Body language, facial expression, tone of voice, and one unmistakable Anglo-Saxon word all suggested that the short Varangian was seeking an excuse to visit Candida in the middle of the night for the purposes of sexual intercourse, and that the taller Varangian disapproved of it. The short, horny Varangian disagreed with this assessment, and, as proof of its inaccuracy, suggested he remain below while the tall one accompany Hira upstairs to Basina. Tall one agreed to this, and marched Hira up three broad, shallow flights of marble steps, finally arriving at tall, decorated double doors, visible as a tangerine-colored sunrise was coming in through windows overlooking the stairwell. At this point, more Varangian guards challenged them, speaking in Anglo-Saxon, which Hira also does not speak. After a brief conversation, during which Hira's physical endowments were obviously being closely assessed, she and the tall Varangian were allowed into the antechamber of the apartments, made of marble, with serpentine inlaid heavily in patterns on the floor, high ceilings, eunuchs in abundance. Hira was handed over to one of them, and tall Varangian dismissed. The eunuch took her into a chamber with windows overlooking a courtyard. This room had golden-tiled ceilings and smelled of incense. A woman in her early 30s, Vasina, was in the central, extremely ornate bed. There were smaller beds along the walls, and four younger women dressed in long silk gowns were preparing Vasina's jewelry and wardrobe for her. They looked startled by the early morning intrusion. The eunuch presented Hira to Vasina, saying,
"Your ladyship, this woman was found by guards at the bottom of the stairs, claiming she was your handmaiden."
Vasina stared at Hira with a slightly mocking air, as if she could not believe an assassin had been stupid enough to approach from such a direct route. Hira met the look calmly, held out the amphora, and said,
"The scented water for your headache, m'lady."
She spoke with a small, reassuring smile, and then winked at Vasina. Vasina showed no reaction at all to the wink. After a few more heartbeats, she instructed the eunuch,
"Leave her here and wait outside."
The eunuch released her and left. Before the door had closed, the four young women had surrounded Hira at a distance of perhaps a yard, each with a hand on the eating knife at her belt. See Mortimer Shore's Mars No. 19 for more on these. They are short blades, nominally for cutting food during meals, not considered weapons, but obviously capable of being used as such.
"What are you wearing under that?"
asked Vasina of the shift.
"That's from the bathhouse. I would never dress my servants so poorly."
She had a low voice and spoke slowly, sounding sardonically amused. Hira set down the amphora and in one smooth gesture pulled the shift over her head. It dropped to the ground at her feet, leaving her nude. Vasina continued to stare at her, now a little appraisingly.
"I see," she said.
Her attendant sniggered slightly, but she made a harsh, wordless noise of disapproval, and they all instantly went silent. Finally, Vasina asked,
"Are you a gift? Who sent you?" "Someone who would be your friend," said Hira.
Vasina smiled, then chuckled like a contented hen.
"Everyone wants to be my friend," she said. "Most of them bore me." "I am sent from someone who will not bore you," Hira said. "But I am under instructions to reveal more only when we are alone together." "We're alone," said Vasina comfortably. "My women are nothing but an extension of me."
Adopting a very gentle tone of voice, almost sympathetic, Hira said,
"I have reason to believe that might not be true."
Vasina frowned and sat up, throwing the sheets off of herself. The clutch of attendants stepped in closer and brandished their eating knives.
"Who says so?"
demanded Vasina. Hira met her gaze and said nothing. After a long moment, Vasina ordered her women,
"Check her."
Hira then submitted to a body cavity search, which was unpleasant but brief. Once they found nothing on/in her, Vasina ordered the four of them out of the room. They protested, shocked and angry, but she grunted at them, and they left. When Vasina and Hira were alone, there was a long pause.
"I detect some glamour," said Vasina at length. "Who has sent you?"
"Nobody you know, m'lady," said Hira. "A company of good men and women who seek your aid. We are from far away, in every possible sense."
Vasina listened, took a moment. In general, her movements and words were slow and languid. And then said in a bored and long-suffering tone,
"What is desired of me?"
"A clandestine introduction to a member of the court."
"It is a rather large court, girl. Can you be more specific?"
"There is a court apothecary who is also responsible for the maintenance of the herb gardens."
"Let me guess,"
Vasina said with a throaty laugh.
"Somebody wants Kalonji. It's always Kalonji."
Hira suppressed surprise and asked,
"Who else wants Kalonji?"
"Everyone. Every witch I've ever met, especially Franks. Since nobody can seem to make it thrive in the North, Cyril Arcadius, the apothecary, would be a very wealthy man if he sold it. Then he could buy himself as many ladies' favors as he liked. He prefers the barter method, guessed Hera. He finds it romantic, Bessina laughed. I'm prepared to barter, said Hera. This should be simple. Honeybee, Bessina said in a knowing voice. Nothing is ever simple.
Although she was fairly certain of what was coming, from her experiences on the first three strands, Hera kept a blank look of innocence on her face and asked,
What isn't simple about Cyril Arcadius? He likes a witch to be performing magic. Any little spell, nothing dramatic, while he's taking her. Makes him feel like he's somehow part of the magic-making. It's pathetic.
This is not what Hera had expected. As on previous strands, Bessina had simply alerted her to various peccadilloes of the apothecaries, none of which fazed her. This variation posed a serious problem, however.
I am not a witch, said Hera. I can't offer that. Bessina shrugged. Well, she said after a moment. I suppose I could be your proxy, if you will be my proxy for another matter.
Meaning?
I am expected in His Majesty's chamber this evening, said Bessina.
Hera knew from dork prep that the Emperor, Alexius III Angelos, was married to Euphrosyne Doukena Kamatera, a first-class alpha bitch who, despite being famously adulterous herself, would eviscerate anyone found fiddling with her wussy husband's tackle box, especially since she'd only given him daughters. That is not what surprised Hera about the news of this dalliance. Rather, it was this.
Aren't you a kinswoman of his? Honeybee, said Bessina. It's the Imperial Court. We're all each other's blood cousins. Why do you think everyone fights so dirty? I would prefer to be in someone else's bed tonight, that's all. So I need somebody to distract His Majesty, and I need it to be a stranger, so she can vanish before Euphrosyne hunts her down and gouges her eyes out. Is the Emperor expecting you? I was summoned by his cupbearer. So, somebody is expecting me, she said. But it might be his wife trying to entrap me.
Ah, said Hera.
Yes, said Bessina. If you open that wooden cabinet over there, you'll find my summer gowns. Help yourself to any but the purple one. I'll have the maids oil and dress your hair to resemble mine. But I will not trust you with my jewelry.
Very well, said Hera, wishing Dork's curriculum included a mandatory anti-assassin workshop.
Spend the day in here. You'd be underfoot anywhere else.
Hera dressed herself in the most modest of the several gowns, all garish by modern standards, with tremendous amounts of small garnets and turquoise sewn onto the fronts, as well as decorative stitching in silver and gold thread. She then received, grudging and ungentle, ministrations from Bessina's attendants, who attempted to goad her into revealing her identity until Bessina told them to shut it. Hera was left alone in the chamber for approximately 5 hours, until Bessina and her entourage returned, the entourage tittering, Bessina looking pleased with herself. In her hand, Bessina held a black silk drawstring bag, half the size of a human fist.
That was painless. Here are your Kalonji seeds, she said,
and tossed them onto Hera's lap.
Keep them tied to your belt, or better yet, your wrist.
When am I to go to the Emperor's chambers?
Hera asked.
After nightfall, said Bessina. One of his eunuchs will come with a summons. Have you eaten today?
When Hera said that she had not, Bessina sent two of her retinue down to the kitchens to bring up fruit and nuts and cheese, further cementing the attendant's resentment. A mediocre lute-playing eunuch came in to entertain them, until Basina got tired of him and sent him away. And finally, after the sun had set, Basina excused herself to go to her other lover's bed.
"Do not abuse her," she ordered her sulking retinue. "If I hear of any bad behavior on your part, I'll have you flayed by that genuine His Majesty keeps in the cellars."
She departed, leaving Hera alone with the seething attendants. All efforts on her part to gather intelligence from them met with complete failure, as they were barely able to contain themselves from tearing her garments off her, a la Cinderella's stepsisters. Finally, the Emperor's eunuch came in search of Basina. When the attendants presented Hera in her stead, he blinked a moment, then sighed, then rolled his eyes, shook his head, and lugubriously gestured her to follow him. The attendants were pleased by this response, and one of them whispered,
"Surely he is leading you straight to what should have been Basina's death, ha!"
Followed by a Greek term with no perfect translation, but meant, in essence, sucker. The eunuch led her through such a maze of torch and lamp-lit stairwells, corridors, halls, and yards that she became disoriented and is not able to reconstruct the route for us, shown as literally a gray area on the Dorkcad rendering. But eventually she was brought to a grand set of copper-faced double doors with intricate gold chase work as decoration. The eunuch rapped on one of these with a particular staccato rhythm, and in response, the doors swung outward toward them. Ahead of them was a very small vestibule, candlelit, with one door to the right and one to the left. We know from old maps, digitized and cleaned up in Dorkcad, that these led to the emperor's and empress's respective bedchambers. The eunuch, giving her a mournful look, literally shoved her into the vestibule and turned his back. As the door began to swing shut, a smooth, strong hand grabbed Hera's arm, and she felt a slender blade press against her carotid artery. As her self-defense skill set is of the flight-not-fight variety, she froze.
"Finally, Basina," said a woman's voice, harshly happy. "Finally, I have caught you in the act."
"I am not Basina, Your Majesty," said Hera. "I am simply an entertainer, obeying a command from my emperor."
There was some cursing, the knife blade was removed, the hand loosened its grip, and she turned so that her back was to the wall and she could face her assailant in the candlelight. The Empress Euphrosyne was considerably older than her, but still in a ravaged, cougar-esque sort of way. Definitely pretty hot.
"Who are you? You can't go in there," said Euphrosyne. "I know what happens when a whore gives an emperor a son. If he doesn't get one from me, he doesn't get one from anyone. Nobody is going to rob my daughters of the throne."
"I'm Jewish," Hera said. "No son of mine would ever be allowed on the throne, no matter who his father is."
Euphrosyne looked surprised.
"He would never be a Jewess," she said.
"He saw me dance at a feast a fortnight back and made inquiries. We've never spoken in person, but he has already paid a great deal and I am tardy. Given I am no threat to Your Majesty, may I attend to my Emperor's wishes?"
Everything about Euphrosyne's demeanor changed as it sank in. She gestured to the door that led to the Imperial bedchamber.
"Go on then," she said. "I don't care if you fuck him. In fact, fuck him thoroughly so I don't have to worry about his fucking anyone else tonight."
With these words of encouragement, she opened the door herself. It was a very large room, marble floors, and panels of marble for walls, ceiling of glassed gold-leaf tile looking burnished in the flickering light from a dozen beeswax candles. One entire wall opened onto a balcony that overlooked a garden. In the middle of the room was the single piece of furniture, a large bed that appeared to be carved out of solid turquoise, and on this sat a sickly pale dark-haired man who did not look at all what Hera expected of an emperor. He was wearing a nightshirt, which was thick white silk with gold thread sewn into the collar, cuffs, and hems. He looked up expectantly when he saw her, and then pulled his head back, like a surprised turtle.
"Where's Basina?"
he demanded, standing nervously.
"Basina was ill tonight, Your Majesty," said Hera with a reassuring smile. "She sent me to entertain you in her absence."
"You're an assassin,"
said His Majesty.
"Of course not, Your Majesty," said Hera pleasantly. "I am here entirely for your pleasure."
"No, you're an assassin. You must be an assassin. I've never seen you before, and you came in here without my eunuch."
"Your honored wife sent the eunuch away in the antechamber," said Hera. "She wanted to speak to me in private before I came into you."
"Did she tell you to assassinate me?"
"Your Majesty," said Hera, looking graciously shocked. "Of course not. She herself is so solicitous of your safety that she would not allow me in until she had reassured herself of my benign intentions. She has deigned to allow me to enter your bedchamber."
"Prove that you're not an assassin,"
he said, not moving from his defensive stance by the side of the bed. Hera continued to smile at him, adjusting the tone of the smile to try to reassure and calm him. She shimmied easily out of Basina's long royal blue robe, which she had not fully secured, specifically so that she could remove it easily. Because of all the jewels and stiff metallic thread, it landed inelegantly, but she stepped out of it with a sinuous grace, presenting as much of herself as possible directly to him. She slipped the drawstring of the Kalonji seed bag over her wrist and palmed it. Entirely unclothed, she smiled invitingly at him, crossed to him, and took his hand with her free one. He stared at his hand in hers as if this was an experience he had never had before. She examined his face. He seemed on the verge of a panic attack.
"Would Your Majesty like to examine my person himself, to see that I have no weapons?"
She ran his hand across her breasts, and then down her belly and between her legs.
"Please inspect as carefully as you would like,"
she whispered into his ear, and closed her lips over his earlobe. He began to tremble.
"If you're not an assassin, you must be a spy,"
he said, pulling his head away.
"You're from that navy of so-called pilgrims that are wintering in Zara, aren't you?"
"I do not know what you speak of, Your Majesty,"
she said, and squeezed his hand between her thighs. He made a confused moaning sound, but tried to pull his hand away.
"You're from Montferrat, aren't you?"
"I have never heard of Montferrat, Your Majesty,"
she whispered, and again closed her lips upon his earlobe. Then she licked the back of his ear. A moment later, he was naked atop her, bucking away, and a few moments after that, with a loud sob of relief, he finished and lay panting on top of her. Immediately, the door to the chamber pushed open, and Empress Euphrosyne stormed in with two large Varangian guards behind her. The emperor did not bother to raise his head.
"Thank you," said Euphrosyne briskly. "Alexios, get off of her. We're sending her home."
Without further acknowledging Hera, the emperor rolled over on the bed and lay staring up at the gold-tiled ceiling with a morose expression. The empress picked up Basina's blue gown, and Hera held her hand out for it.
"I don't think so,"
Euphrosyne said with a laugh, and tossed it into a corner.
"Alexios, I'm giving her your nightshirt to wear."
The emperor was already asleep. Euphrosyne picked up the garment and tossed it to Hera.
"Put that on quickly, Jewess. These men are taking you back to Pera."
This was convenient enough, as the second part of Hera's task was to get across the Golden Horn to Pera, to leave the Kalonji seeds with another witch, KCW from previous strands, but still a stranger in this one, in the Jewish section of the city. Getting an armed imperial escort was not how she had done it in previous strands, but this would take less effort on her part. One of the guards offered her a woolen cloak, and she wrapped it round her shoulders. She allowed them to take her down various flights of stairs and across yards and gardens and halls and down corridors until she was once again disoriented. Eventually, the smell of briny water began to waft past her nostrils, so she was not surprised when they came to an enormous wooden gate that opened onto a street at the edge of the water. There was a boat with two oarsmen who wordlessly rowed them across the Golden Horn, the deep protected harbor, less than two bowshots wide, that led to the hilly northern suburb of Pera, in the shadow of Galata Tower. Upon landing at the foot of the steep hill, not an official dock, although there were several in either direction, the oarsmen secured the boat, and the two guards got out and then hoisted her directly to the shore. Throughout this, she had maintained her firm hold on the Kalonji seed bag, and now was mindful not to let the harbor water touch it.
"Where's your home?"
asked one of the guards, with the clumsy, angry-sounding accent of the Britons, who made up such a large percentage of the Varangian force. Suppressing a mischievous urge to address him in modern English, she responded in Greek.
"It is directly behind the synagogue," she said. "My father is Avraham ben Moises. I will show you."
The three of them marched up the steep hill along the street, which was not very broad, but paved with stones and well maintained. About halfway up was the synagogue, a large building with a fenced garden. Hira directed them to the rows of neat wooden homes behind this, all dark as it was now about midnight. In the middle row of houses, set on leveled-off stone foundations, Hira pointed to one house in particular. One of the guards took her by the shoulder, and the other pounded on the door. After a confused moment, there were voices within both this house and the surrounding homes, and candlelight appeared in windows. Eventually, the door opened, and a man, barely old enough to be Hira's father, opened the door. He sported a long beard, longish hair covered by a felt cap, and dark robes. A woman, obviously his wife, stood behind him, and behind her were the shadowy forms of several children, ranging in age from approximately 7 to full grown.
"What do you want?"
asked the man in Greek, fearful, staring up at the Varangian guard.
"We've brought your daughter back,"
said the guard, sounding bored.
"Our what?"
the man said, amazed.
"Your daughter,"
repeated the guard, in a warning voice.
"All of our daughters are here with us already,"
the man said, looking alarmed and confused. The guard took a step forward to tower over him in the doorway.
"To disown your daughter because she has been with the Emperor is to disown the Emperor himself,"
he said warningly.
"Either you receive her into your home, or I will bring you back to answer to His Majesty for the insult directly."
Looking mystified and a bit spooked, the man stepped back into the house and somewhat robotically held his arm out in a gesture of welcome. The other guard pushed Hira through the doorway.
"Abba,"
said Hira in a happy voice, throwing her arms around him, and then turning to his equally mystified wife.
"Ima."
The woman very woodenly put her arms around her. Then Rachel, the oldest of their daughters, late teens, and Hira's connection, gasped as if remembering or realizing something and said,
"Oh, my dearest sister, I'm so glad to see you safely home."
She threw her arms around Hira with a bear hug. To her younger siblings, she said emphatically,
"Is it not wonderful to have our sister home again?"
They gave her strange looks.
"Pretend you know her and welcome her home,"
Rachel whispered fiercely in Hebrew. The children immediately surrounded Hira and hugged her with feigned enthusiasm.
"The Emperor thanks you,"
said the senior guard to the father.
"But the Empress requests that you keep your daughters closer to home from now on."
"Yes, of course, sir,"
stuttered the father. The other guard added,
"I'd marry this one off as soon as possible. If nobody in Pera wants her, I've got some connections in town who would be happy to take her off your hands. Get a great price with those tits.
I'll take that into consideration, thank you,
said the father. This man pulled back his helmet to give Avraham a clear view of his face.
Name's Bruno, Bruno of Hamelin,
he said agreeably.
You can ask for me via the Imperial Kitchens. The head cook's a kinsman through marriage.
He winked at Hera, and then turned his attention back to the father.
I'll take 15% commission. Think about it.
The guards left. As soon as the door was closed, the younger children pulled away from her and scurried behind their mother, as Hera turned to face the family. Rachel looked delighted, but the father and mother were frowning unhappily, and the younger children took their cues from this.
Thank you, said Hera in Hebrew, in her most winsome smile. I apologize profusely for the alarm and confusion I've just caused you. Please allow me to explain the peculiar circumstances of our meeting.
She then revealed herself as working with a witch network. She shared as much as she safely could and requested their permission to leave the Kalonji seeds with them until her associate came to collect them, which she anticipated would be within a day or two. Persuasive narrative is one of her specialties. Due to her innate charisma and agreeable demeanor, by the time she'd finished, the entire household had relaxed and adopted a more welcoming air. The family, as we knew from previous strands, has a commitment to protecting fellow witches, and agreed readily to assist her. In fact, the daughter Rachel pressed her for more information about the witch network she was working with, and expressed a desire to go adventuring with Hera in other times and places, despite Moise's quiet disapproval.
When my associate Felix comes to collect the bag, you may speak more with him about it, Hera suggested. In the meantime, please be kind enough to send me back to my own home.
I shall do that, said the mother.
Oh, Ima, please let me try, said Rachel. I would love to know I can help such interesting people to have such marvelous adventures out in the world.
The mother was about to agree, but Moises interrupted.
Your mother will do it, he said. You are too eager.
Hera smiled at Rachel.
I was like you at your age, she said, except I did not have the powers you have. You will certainly be a remarkable force for good in the world, if you make your mind up to be so.
Rachel looked rapturous.
You are welcome to invade our home, but not our daughter's mind, said Moises curtly. Sarah, send this woman back where she came from. Before I decide to follow Bruno's advice and sell her off.
At 5:10 the morning after her departure, Hera was homed to Odek number 2, uninjured.
Post by Dr. Roger Blevins to Dr. Melisande Stokes on Private Odin Channel 15:32-37. Day 627, mid-April, year 2.
Have reviewed your after-action reports on Hera Yassin's series of deeds in the Blacherne Palace. All are too long, editorialized, and, frankly, tawdry. Revise to reflect the professional standards of Dodo, and see to it all future reports remain within department guidelines, brief, containing salient facts only. Allowing a chatty tone, personal timbre, etc., to seep into your reports is unprofessional, Dr. Stokes. As such, it is, by the letter of Dodo policy, grounds for being placed on a performance enhancement plan, which I need not remind you may culminate in demotion or dismissal. It might behoove you to review the transcripts of the recent congressional hearings, during which we were raked over the coals by various red state senators for even suggesting that sexual activity might be involved in diachronic operations. In the future, any doer actions of this nature are to be downplayed to the greatest extent possible that is consistent with accurate record keeping. This is not a Nora Roberts novel. R.B.
After Action Report. Debriefer, Dr. Melisande Stokes. Doer, Felix Dorn. Theater.